The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, from time to time, things happen in the world that have a big impact on many of us, and certainly on me. And I often feel, sometimes when this happens, I feel that I deserve some talking about in this setting, but I feel unprepared to do so. And sometimes I'm just impelled to do it anyway. But one variation of this is that often enough what happens is related to hate, and I feel like I should really talk about hate, but I feel unprepared. It seems like such a topic, big topic, deep topic. I don't know how to talk about hate in this context. And I've come to that kind of place again, and I still feel unprepared to talk about it. But I can't do anything else. So maybe this is an exploration of the topic, a very important topic for our society. And kind of the way into the exploration that comes kind of naturally to me is to refer back to these ancient teachings of the Buddha and to look at what he had to say about the topic of hate. And hopefully that helps our exploration of it, consideration of it. So the word for hate could equally be translated as hostility is dosa, D-O-S-A. And one of the most famous occurrences of this this particular word is in a verse, four-line poem from the Dhammapada, which has had an illustrious history down through the centuries. That had a big impact on variety, right up to the 20th century. And I wrote a newsletter article about this verse, the Buddha's poem on peace, last year. And it goes something like this. Hate, dosa, hate is never overcome by hate. Only by, and most translations say love, only by love is hate overcome. This is the ancient truth, ancient teaching. And so, you know, it's as a little soundbite, it's very powerful, and it's used in different settings, and, you know, if people take it in a certain way, it has a powerful lesson. If we think about how much hate there is and how hate begets more hate, for example. So this is a poem of peace. And the word for that's usually translated as love, only by love is hate overcome, is not actually love. It just, that's what we want it to be. And it's reasonable that it's translated as love, but the literal word in the ancient world, ancient language, is non-hate, adosa. It's very common for to be understood in this ancient language that when there's a negative prefix, a, in front of a word, it implies the opposite. It doesn't imply simply the absence of something, but implies the positive opposite. Somehow that's a linguistic feature of that language. And so the opposite of hate, you know, love seems like a pretty obvious candidate. So that's nice. And there are other opposites maybe. Or by saying non-hate, it's implying something positive, but it actually doesn't define it very exactly. It includes a range of concepts, maybe generosity, maybe kindness rather than love, maybe respect, maybe appreciation. There's a variety of different kind of states that we can, that fits into that category of non-hate. And when we have a word like love, even though love is kind of vague in English, you know, somehow, it still specifies that it's something. And then we feel like we have to fit that thing. And we make ourselves into that thing. But what's beautiful, I think, or profound about referring to the negative, the absence of something, is in the absence of hate, in the absence of defilements, absence of attachment, if then what arises, what comes? One of the marvelous things about meditation, it can be for some people the shedding of preoccupations, shedding of attachments, quieting of the mind that's caught up in its hindrances and desires and aversions and all kinds of things. And the mind gets quiet and peaceful. Quiet and peaceful, even the kind of usual conceits around self and self-concern fall away. And a person can feel quite peaceful and content and could say, yes, there's no hate now. But then it makes room for something to arise from within that maybe will not be love, maybe it's respect, maybe it's generosity, maybe it's something, who knows what the circumstance calls for us to feel and to be. And so to not specify what it has to look like, maybe there's a lot of wisdom for people who have the ability to let go deeply and allow the deeper inner part of our inner life bubble up into this field that's not obscured by things like greed or hatred or delusion. Those three, greed, hatred, and delusion, are considered to, in the Buddha's teachings, the fundamental root, the fundamental cause or condition for all unethical behavior. So if it happened to have been once upon a time that any of you did anything unethical, then chances are that in the background of that was greed, hate, and delusion. One of them, two of them, all three of them maybe were operating. If you read about unethical things going on in the world, for the Buddha's analysis, not far beneath the surface of that is the psychological conditions of greed, hatred, and delusion are operating in some person or some people. And so part of the Dharma practice is to kind of delve deep inside of oneself to discover what those roots are. So they're called roots, and they're also called poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. And that's a powerful metaphor because it speaks to how these things are poisons. And especially you can see with hate. Hate is a poison. It poisons the person who has it, and it poisons the much of the world around it. In fact, part of the, what's happening in our society is the spreading and growing of hate, and almost an industry that is built around perpetuating, developing, enhancing, creating hate, not just in this country, but in many countries in the world. And so it's a poison that can spread and spread and spread. And it's a poison that is where this ancient poem, hate has never come overcome by hate. But it's easy enough to be the recipient of hate and then to hate in return. And there the division happens. There the perpetuation happens. The poison has begun to spread. It's doing its work in society if we respond to hate with hate. So the Buddha, there were people who encountered the Buddha and said to the Buddha, I see who you are now. You're embodying loving kindness. And the Buddha said, no, don't say that. But if you say that I embodied the opposite of loving kindness, I embody the absence of ill will, I allow you to say that. So here he is. He doesn't want to be narrowed down to being someone who's love or has loving kindness, it's a little bit jarring, a little bit this cognitive dissonance to some of us that the Buddha would say, no, I'm not loving, or don't define me that way. But he is willing to be defined by the absence of ill will. I see this, as I'm repeating myself, I see this as a call to really do the inner work, do our own personal work, to get to the bottom of our ill will and empty ourselves of it, free ourselves of it, and then see what wants to come, see what wants to flow out. Which, that work wouldn't get done if the Buddha had said, for example, oh yeah, you know, I'm so loving. and then, oh, we're supposed to be loving like the Buddha. Okay, let's, you know, put on the loving coat, you know, whatever, the loving persona. And then it covers over the fact that actually inside there's all this ill will. And some people can, with a tremendous force of will, can cover over the deeper poisons that exist in them. And maybe it can stay hidden for years and years. One of the sad things is that occasionally you see people who have done something like that for years, have a public persona that's been successful, but then they start getting senility, and they can't keep it up, and so that surface persona falls away, and lo and behold, there's all this venom, poison underneath, and it's a shock to people to start seeing this. And there's also the opposite that's been seen, that people start getting Alzheimer's and they just get more and more loving. It's like they've done their work or whatever. They don't have that inside. And, you know, the great story is a friend of mine, a friend of mine who went to see a person who was very accomplished in the world, apparently was the president of the American Association of Psychology or something, and went to see this man, was invited over for dinner, knocked on the door, and sure enough, this man opened the door, and he said, looked at them, and he said, I don't have a clue who you are. They'd known each other for decades. I don't have a clue who you are, but you're welcome in my house. So this idea of doing the inner work, getting to the bottom of all this, requires a lot of courage and a lot of honesty. The willingness to kind of look inside and identify in ourselves that there is hostility, hatred, as a theme of today, ill will, aversion that's there. And the word hate is a big word, and I think many of us, probably, my guess is a lot of us don't go around thinking of ourselves as hating people, or you're actively going around hating too much. But if we think of the word as hostility, and if we think of hostility as being very, even the most minor hostility, I have now, for the last few weeks, a wonderfully complex relationship with ants in my kitchen. And I am doing my darndest to... you know, to not have them in the kitchen without harming them. And they're so persistent. Yesterday I woke up and I have certain things in, I've made little moats, you know, little water things, you know, things sitting in the water. And yesterday they managed to get somehow across the water. I don't know if they're swimming, and some of them are dead, but some swim across, or whether, one friend said they probably make little bridges, they hold on to each other, and I don't know what they do, but, so there's certainly impatience that comes up for me, it's annoyance, and those, you know, if I look carefully at the impatience and the annoyance, you know, I don't want to admit it publicly to all of you. But what I won't admit is if I think that probably underneath that is some degree of hostility towards that dance. And so, you know, it's wonderfully complex and I get to look at it. And so that's a small thing, something like that. it's bigger when we're talking about feelings we have towards people. And that's why it's such a big thing in the news right now, because we have people killing each other or killing other people out of this tremendous hostility and hate that exists. And it's hostility and hate which is being praised, supported. There's a whole, you know, there's a whole community of people who, for the language of hate, hating the other, hating the immigrants, hating the, you know, all kinds of races and classes of people and all kinds of things. There's all these websites where people are meeting in community, and people who study these website communities say that if a person doesn't have any, if a person indicates any kind of willingness to not just have pure hate for the other, they get pushed out of the community. That's kind of the language of it. That's kind of like the, how they bond and what's supported. And so that just gets supported more and more. And so it's not surprising that some people get pushed into a certain kind of deluded mental state, or that's all they're thinking about, and they get, at some point, they get pushed over the edge. The this interesting analogy for hate that's given in the ancient texts, that hate is like a forest fire that burns the fuel that it depends on. So like, you know, a grass fire. I think it actually is grass fire. So, you know, the grass, it's, the fire is burning on the grass. It's burning up the grass. And when the grass is burned out, then the fire goes out. So it's burning up the very thing that it depends on. And so how does hate burn ourselves? Does it burn ourselves up? And some of the most dramatic examples we've had of, you know, the killer gets killed. You know, it seems like something has burned up, some kind of humanity has burned up inside, that a person would do these things. The and so the poem says, hate will never end with hate, by non-hate only will hate come to an end. And so how do we meet with non-hate? There's one kind of story of the Buddha, of a man. Buddha had a number of people who were hostile towards him and angry towards him. So, you know, he didn't just, you know, float in the cloud and everything was nice around him. And one man came to him and was saying angry things to the Buddha, and showed up and started giving the Buddha, I guess, a piece of his mind. And the Buddha apparently just sat quietly and listened to this. And then when it was over, he said to the man, if you go to visit someone's home, like a friend, and you come with a gift, and you offer the gift, but the host doesn't take it, who does the gift then belong to? And the man said, oh, then it's still mine. In the same way, I don't accept your anger. So that's a kind of interesting response. You know, imagine that that was not, maybe the tone of voice could have been hostile, but I can imagine that said could be said in a calm, relaxed way, and it kind of leaves the, you know, the person that not doesn't have any impact, the anger they had, the desired impact, but the left leaves the person carrying it or feeling it or really like I'm the one. I've known not a few people who have struggled with something like anger or resentment for years and years towards someone. And mostly I talk to meditators, so maybe that's why it's my examples are meditating people. But then in meditation or coming out of the meditation, at some point realizing that the person they're resentful for probably has long since forgotten them. You know, it's been so long. You know, that person's not thinking about them, even though the angry person is kind of angry regularly, you know, and then realize, wait a minute, who's being damaged here? Who's being hurt here? I kind of wanted to get revenge, and I keep having these revenge thoughts, but, you know, after all these decades, you know, I'm the one who's harmed. And in a sense, so some people will say that you're doing the work for your enemy. You know, the enemy wants to get to you, and they got to you, and by you having this constant living in hate, living in anger and all that. And so so to see it that way kind of reframes it and kind of takes away some of the justification or rationale for living with hate and anger when we realize how much we're hurting ourselves. It's not easy to do the inner work of coming to the roots underneath and really seeing what's going on with when there's hate. But in the ancient Buddhist tradition, they point to two primary causes for hate. And one is frustrated desire. And so this idea that I want something and I need it or I have to have it and not being able to get it is a huge source of the momentum of hatred in the society. They're saying that some of the, you know, a lot of these people who do mass shootings are young men, young white men, and in their early 20s or late teens or something like that. And it seems like there's a lot of hatred towards women as part of it. And it seems like part of that hatred towards women is not having loving relationships with women. So there's this, the frustration builds to kind of anger and to hatred. And so underneath all that is to look at desire and what's the nature of desire and how do we relate to frustrated desire. One of the great benefits of doing regular meditation, and you have to do it kind of regularly, meaning you have to be kind of committed to do it so that all the different flavors of who you are get a chance to get processed through meditation. If you only do a meditation when you feel good, you get, you know, maybe you get the, you know, your ideal persona, who you like to be. If you only do meditation when you feel bad, you get another impression of yourself. But you know, you do, you're supposed to do it regularly, so you go, you get the cross section of all the different ways you can be. But one of the great things about meditation, a really good thing about meditation that we don't say publicly in the advertisements. If you can charge, you can accuse us for false advertisement. Is being uncomfortable. It's actually some of those times when you go cross section of who you are, it's actually phenomenally important that you have an uncomfortable meditation. That you have meditation that's really restless, where you're filled with venom, where you're filled with, you know, greed, and you're just like impatient, and nothing's working, and you're really frustrated. When that happens to you, you say, wow, it's finally happened. Now my work begins. And to learn to sit with that, there's a number of things. One of the things is to learn how to make your peace with that. Rather than having those feelings continue to motivate you to think, act, feel in unhealthy ways. To learn to kind of step back and observe and just be present and breathe with it without it getting the upper hand. You have the upper hand by just observing and being it. And so learning to be comfortable with discomfort is phenomenally important. And so when there is something frustrated desire that comes up, then we've learned how to be present for it without it pushing, impelling us to do things that later we regret. That it spills over into something like hate or ill will or anger or whatever we express. So to learn how to be with discomfort so we can be at ease with difficulties that come up in our life is a very important function of meditation. So not that I want all your meditations to be uncomfortable from now on, but it's very, this idea of the cross-section of your life, it's reasonable that sooner or later you'll come and have an uncomfortable meditation. And rather than feeling like you failed or it's wrong or it's bad, this is actually a very important part of the whole path of meditation. And I'd encourage you to embrace it as part of the meditation and be with it, stay with it to see it through to the other side. Or into the or to the depths, or whatever your metaphor you like. So, frustrated desire as a cause for hatred. Another important one is fear. And to people get afraid of being hurt, afraid of the threat that's coming, And so fear, hatred, ill will, pushing things away that are threatening is almost a deep instinct. But if it's an instinct that it comes out of fear, what happens if we change our relationship to fear? If we do the same thing as I said about discomfort, when fear arises in meditation, don't be in a hurry to get rid of it. Fix it. Analyze it. Solve it. Learn first to sit with fear and be afraid without, to have there be fear without you being afraid. To have fear present, but you don't identify with it, or it hasn't taken over, or hasn't saturated you so fully that, you know, I'm the one who's afraid. There's fear that's present. And then, when fear arises, we have the capacity to bring mindfulness to it, awareness to it, presence to it, rather than it automatically triggering something like hatred, or automatically triggering other unhealthy things that fear can trigger. And to learn to sit with fear and be quiet with fear and wise with fear is also one of the tasks of meditation. So if you feel afraid in your meditation someday, you should congratulate yourself. Finally, it's my turn. For some of you, your turn with fear will come sooner. Some of you, it'll come later. Some of you, it'll come sooner and later. I've had my dealing with fear in meditation and in my spiritual life. And it's a cycle through at different times. And I've had to kind of look at it and be with it and get to the bottom of it. But just simply the idea of being able to breathe with fear and be present with fear and hold it in the body and just let it be there as a phenomena that's there, as opposed to it being my fear that somehow, you know, I'm identified with or caught with or reacting to, is powerful. So to be able to understand ourselves more deeply as a response to some of the big tragedies that goes on and some of the big political things going on. I was partly motivated to talk about this because as I read the news and read the state of the current, not just the United States, but other countries in the world too, that hate now, I think, is kind of like it seems to me like what was 50 years ago was struggles over political ideology. It's not, you know, where that, you know, you can talk ideology. Now it's not political ideology that's in the forefront, but rather it's the ideology of hate. You know, it's a hatred which is being perpetuated and developed, and, you know, money is going into supporting and perpetuating, evoking fear, hatred in people. And so as a society, we really have to look at this and see how it's being spread and how it's being supported. And so if we really feel really charged by this, or really upset, or really somehow has a big impact on what we see in society, the mass killings and on, these things that go on, from a Buddhist point of view, from Buddhist practice point of view, it's not the only point of view you should have, but from a Buddhist practice point of view, I think the appropriate response, one appropriate response, is how will I now be changed by this? How will I now become a better person by this? If we see what's going on in the world around us, whatever the tragedies might be, whatever the horrible things might be, and the way we think always is, they should fix it. The problem is out there. They're the ones who are doing something wrong. I'm virtuous, but they're wrong, they're bad. Someone has to fix them. We have to get rid of them. From a Buddhist practice point of view, that's the wrong place to begin. From the point of view of Buddhist practice, the question is, given what's happening in this world, this has a big impact on me, what just happened. I'm thinking about it, I'm concerned with it, I'm horrified, I'm upset, I'm motivated. How will I become different? How will I change? If change begins with yourself, with the person, so if the topic is hate, if we're seeing huge demonstrations of hate in our society, how will I become less hating? How will I respond to hate in ways that are non-hateful? How do I respond in a way that dissipates or reduces the amount of hate in the people that I encounter? Some of these people who commit hate crimes are people who had horrific lives themselves. They were bullied, they were abused, they were neglected, all kinds of things. Who knows what person you'll meet later today? That if you walk by them and ignore them, you're just one, maybe you're like the camel, the straw that broke the camel's back. One more person who kind of dismissed someone, ignored them in some way that was painful for that person. What if you did the opposite? Maybe, who knows, maybe any one of us can prevent a mass shooting simply because we met someone with kindness and care. I've known people whose lives have been changed completely dramatically by one person's simple act of kindness. They kind of, wow, that's something. Usually the people who've been most dramatically changed by that are the people who are really struggling and having great difficulties. So who knows? Maybe you'll never know that the person you stopped and was kind to, you prevented something horrible happening in their family when they went home, or who knows how you benefited. But if the change doesn't start here, it kind of doesn't make a lot of sense to be focusing so much out there. But if the change can start here, that maybe puts us in a better position to think about the other issues, political issues and other things that have to be addressed. So I'd like to end with a story. And kind of a fable. Once upon a time, there was a monastery. And as happening in monasteries sometimes around the world, all that was left was half a dozen or so old monks. And they were dying out, and no one was coming anymore to the monastery. There's no new recruits coming. Monastery had been continuously inhabited by monastics for 1,000 years. It had been a thriving spiritual center, but it looked like, you know, it was, you know, dying out, coming to the end. And so the abbot, you know, that we have to do something here, and tried different things. And he'd heard that 100 miles away there was a rabbi who was really wise. And even though it was a different religion, this person was really wise. So the abbot went there and explained to the rabbi what was going on. And the rabbi thought about it for a while and said, well, there's really only one thing that I have to tell you. Among you monks there, one of you is the next Christ. What's a strange thing to say. So the abbot went back to the monastery, and everyone was waiting for the abbot to get back, you know, to hear what the rabbi had to say, the wise person. And the abbot said, you know, he only said something very strange. And, you know, all he said was, one of us will be the next Christ. And they all thought, that's strange. So they didn't think about it too much, but over the next days and weeks and months, they started wondering, well, could it be so-and-so, Charlie? I mean, he's always cynical, but he's always ready to help. Or could it be Sam? He's like, you know, he's very, very quiet, but whenever he has something to say, it's always wise. Or could it be, you know, and they kept started to look at each other in new ways. Like, oh, could it be? And they would look and wonder, and they started treating each other kinder and nicer and with more kind of care and respect. And they started feeling kind of the atmosphere in the monastery kind of changed. And from time to time, there were young people from town who'd come to the monastery grounds for picnics. And some of them kind of picked up that something was different here. And they started kind of talking with the monks and were kind of struck by something special was going on here. And then some of the young men said, well, I'll go live there for a while and let me get ordained and become a monk and live the spiritual life. And within a few years, the whole place was now a thriving spiritual center again. So maybe, just maybe, one of the people you're going to encounter this week is the next Buddha. Please don't hate anyone, because who knows, might be the next Buddha if you meet the person well. So study your hate, get to the bottom of it. Don't take these hate things in the world as only things out there. From a Buddhist point of view, really reflect and think about how you want to change and how you want to change to be better. And with what eyes do you want to see the people around you? And if you look upon all people as maybe that's the one who's the next Buddha, the next Christ, the next something. Maybe we'll make a better world. So, thank you. And we can start now. And here is the idea. That since we have a few minutes before the tea, if maybe you could just turn around to 2, 3, 4 people around you. And if someone's around you and doesn't have a partner, invite them in. And just say some simple, a little bit quiet words, because otherwise it gets too noisy in here, about some simple statements, short statements, about what was evoked to you today in this talk. So, thank you.